Begin after six taps. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6.
Greetings, and thank you for listening to the FlixWise podcast. I'm your host, Lady P, no relation to Master P. If this is your first time tuning into the show, I'm thrilled to announce that you picked a good one to start with, because today's guest is historian and award-winning author of several notable film texts, including Acting in the Cinema, An Invention Without a Future, Essays on Cinema, The Magic World of Orson Welles, as well as many others. I'm pleased to welcome Professor Emeritus from Indiana University, James Naremore. Thank you so much for agreeing to come on the show.
Well, that sounds like fun. Thank you, Pauline.
Professor Naremore is here to help us navigate all the twists and turns of the 28th movie on the Sight and Sound Critics poll, David Lynch's 2001 feature film, Mulholland Drive. James wrote about Mulholland Drive in the most recent edition of his landmark book, More Than Night, Film Noir and Its Context. We're going to revisit his analysis and talk about how Mulholland Drive fits into the legacy of the noir genre. Then we're going to talk about a filmmaker with a radically different take on life in Los Angeles. James is currently working on a book about the great director Charles Burnett. We're going to explore Burnett's filmography and also talk about the reasons why you may or may not have heard of him. All right, Professor, have you got your coffee?
Yeah, I'm ready.
All right then, crank the Roy Orbison and let's go for a ride. First up, it's David Lynch's 2001 feature film, Mulholland Drive. Where to begin with this movie? The title alone evokes the sordid legends of Los Angeles's municipal and cinematic history. It recalls films like Sunset Boulevard and Chinatown, not just because of the locational specificity, but also because all three films are an attempt to reveal the ominous forces that built and maintained the illusion of La La Land as a romantic, glamorous world of fantasy. Mulholland Drive lets the audience sit shotgun on a winding road lined with plenty of Lynchian phantasmagoria and absurdity. We travel into the damaged psyche of a wannabe actress named Betty Elms, played by Naomi Watts, who serves as a surrogate for all the people who've lost themselves in a moving image. While many films of this ilk are about uncovering an external source of evil, Lynch turns his lens inward, contending that it is our dreams that are poisoning us from within. So, I have not attempted to give a plot synopsis of the movie because I'm not sure where to begin. What would you say is the best way to introduce the movie to someone?
Well, let's just say it involves the story, ostensibly the story, of a perky young woman named Betty who comes to Hollywood, fascinated with the place, checks into an apartment owned by an aunt of hers in a place called Havenhurst, and meets there a strange, beautiful brunette who looks like a movie star herself. And the brunette has amnesia, and Betty goes on an investigation to find out what's wrong. And during that adventure, she also goes in for a Hollywood audition. She pretty much knocks it out of the park. She falls in love with the raven-haired beauty who's wound up in her apartment house. They have an affair. Then everything goes haywire.
Exactly.
And then we emerge in another world where Betty is now a woman named Diane Selwyn, who's has been having an affair with a dark-haired gal who had called herself Rita after Rita Hayworth in the first half of the film, but in the second half is now Diane Selwyn. Everything has turned topsy-turvy because instead of the perky young gal, we have a young woman who's just horribly ended a love affair and has been a failure as an actress and has been humiliated in various ways, and she becomes suicidal. Anyway, that's the I've left out a lot of things.
But exactly. That's the outline. That's the bones of it.
Uh-huh.
But so are you a fan of Mulholland Drive?
Oh yeah, very much.
Yeah.
My fondness for it is not diminished in all these years. Yeah.
Okay. So, what was your initial reaction to the film?
Well, I just loved it. It's one of those, I suppose you could say, typically David Lynch films, in that it's full of all kinds of quotations of other movies. It is a kind of dream movie. It's irrational. It has a plot that defies description and is surreal in many ways. What I found is a little different about it, the only other film of his that struck me the same way is a totally opposite film, The Straight Story, which he made for the Disney Company, which is a kind of realist film.
Yeah.
About a guy riding a tractor through Iowa. But both of those films, they moved me a great deal. I think Mulholland Drive, just I just find it so painful and the sense of lost love of an affair breaking up of the terror of desire. I just think it's a very emotionally powerful film.
Absolutely. I think I had a similar reaction. It's the most moved I've ever been by a Lynch work.
Yeah. Yeah.
Period. I suppose violence always evokes some sort of emotional reaction. So in that way, I guess Blue Velvet is probably the most emotionally moving in a way. But as far as relatability, while the narrative might not necessarily be super coherent, the emotional stakes are so clear.
Yeah, I found. And what happens to me is that in the first half of the movie, it's a rather long half. It's over an hour and a half long, and the second half of the movie is relatively short. But in the first half of the movie, I just basically fall in love with Betty, the Naomi Watts character. Mm-hmm. And then her suffering in the second part of the movie just is so painful to me. And so I just feel kind of... If you've ever had the breakup of a love affair, it really kind of gets to that feeling and the kind of disintegration of personality, that terrible feeling of not being able to either find or let go of this loved object that you're all tied up with. Anyway, I think it really affects me.
Right, and I think. This movie, more so than any other that I've ever seen, really gets to the heart of what it means to love movies.
And yes,
how powerful that connection can be.
Yeah, yeah. In fact, you know, I think in a way, a friend of mine, actually a former student, a guy named Justice Neeland, who wrote a little book on Lynch, and I think he's very, very good at showing how those two things are connected. I mean, the idea of eroticism, desire, the fetishism of movies, so that it's about the love of another person, but it's also about the love of the movies. And that tremendous ending at the movie in the club Silencio, where Rebecca Del Rio sings she sings crying, the Spanish version of it. And she's lip syncing, and she has painted tears on her face. It's sort of like what a movie is, right? I mean, it's the movie is empty. It's just an image up there on the screen. And I don't know, that the same thing happens somehow with desire.
Right. Exactly. It's the fact that it's all an artifice doesn't mean it's
exactly
not powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, he's got the artifice almost in your face there at the end, but in spite of, or maybe because of that, I found myself very powerfully moved by it.
Right, and when I remember seeing, when I saw this for the first time, being so puzzled by the Naomi Watts performance in the first half of the movie. It's so intentionally, she's so intentionally over the top and so sunny and naive, and then it suddenly all made sense. And I don't know if Lynch did this intentionally, but the sort of grating ADR, where it sounds like everything she says has been dubbed in later in the first half.
No, you know, I never have noticed that, but that's interesting. I think it is a star-making performance by Naomi Watts, and I think it's very hard to do that sort of perky blonde ingenue type. It's a cliche. But she makes me like her in spite of that. I think that's hard to do.
Absolutely, yeah. So I want to talk about your book, More Than Night. And in the most recent edition, you write about Mulholland Drive. And you write about its connection to film noir. And so in the book, You talk about how there is no one definition of film noir, that the definition can be amorphous. So how did you decide that Mulholland Drive qualified as a film noir?
To be honest with you, I think I just wanted to write about the movie.
That's fair.
And I was doing a new edition of the book. And so I asked myself, what's the best movie that's like a film noir I've seen in the last decade? And Mulholland Drive was it. But one does not have to talk about Mulholland Drive as a film noir. I mean, obviously it has affiliations with film noir. It's self-consciously quoting film noir, classic examples of film noir at several points. And, you know, one could enumerate all the little factors that make us think about film noir, but it has many other things as well. And basically it's an art movie, isn't it? I mean, I think one of the films that most influenced it was Ingmar Bergman's Persona.
Okay, yes. I definitely wanted to mention that.
And Lynch is an admirer of that film. And I think there's even a, I don't know, I think when Betty and Rita go to bed together, there's even a camera composition that echoes Persona.
Right. Yes, absolutely. Yeah. Yes, that film immediately came to mind as I was watching it.
Right.
And especially when Rita dons the blonde wig and we see they've sort of become each other.
It's a strange disintegration of personality and this kind of play between silence and language. And anyway, yeah.
Absolutely, yeah. And I also, another film that Lynch seems to intentionally be recalling is Vertigo.
Yes, yeah. You know, some people would call Vertigo a film noir, so that's okay.
Okay. But what are some of the, I know we don't want to go into, you know, a bullet point checklist or whatever, but what are some of the signifiers of film noir that we see in the movie?
Well, let me try to explain what, when I was writing about film noir, what my initial approach was. I think most of the generalizations that you read basically in trying to define film noir are very dubious. The standard definition is that it's a type of American movie that was especially striking and important in the period between 1941 and 1958, a Hollywood-style movie, and it derives from a photographic style similar to German Expressionism. There were a lot of German immigrants in Hollywood at that time, and it derives as well from the tradition of American pulp hard-boiled fiction. That's the way people talk about it. But if that's the case, why does it have a French name? And more than that, why? Okay, let's say everybody agrees that The Maltese Falcon is a film noir. But some people also think Vertigo is a film noir. Well, I guess you could say there's a private eye in both films, but the photographic style, it's not the same.
Right.
It's not like a hard-boiled, Vertigo is not a hard-boiled film.
Right.
So anyway, yeah, so I guess my argument is that all categories work this way. They don't work, at least artistic categories, they don't work by this clear-cut set of, you have this particular set of properties. You know, Humphrey Bogart wears a trench coat. There are shadows on the wall. There's a private eye investigation. There's a femme fatale. But there are many, many film noirs who have none of those things in them. And what happens is film A comes along. It's somebody labels it noir. Then film B comes along and they say, well, this has something in common with A, so we'll call it one. Then C comes along and you say, well, this one has something in common with B, so we'll call that one too. And as you go down the string, you keep encountering examples that, you know, may not have anything at all in common with A. And you keep having to revise the definition. So what I tried to argue was film noir is really a critical discourse. Film noir is created by critics. And it has this evocative name. And historically, this name, film noir, comes from France. There were film noirs in France, recognized as film noir, what they used to call the old school of poetic realism in France, in the 1930s. And you could go back further. I mean, is Fritz Lang's M not a film noir in some sense?
So it
just has to go with listing and nominating things that you think have certain qualities. Now, The people who were most influential in establishing the idea of film noir and the people who wrote the first book about it, it was a couple of Frenchmen, Bord and Chamuton, and both of them have very, very strong connections to French surrealism. And in them, I think it becomes very clear that the way the French were designating American movies as film noir, they were saying, these are somewhat like our film noir from the 30s. But they were also saying that they have a particular kind of set of emotional affective qualities that the surrealists admired. They named five qualities, and these were all emotional qualities. They're not about shadows on the wall or anything. Oniric, that is to say, they're dreamlike in some way. Strange. Now, this word strange, that's one way of translating it. In French, the word is insolite, and it's hard to render it. I think it has a lot in common with the Freudian uncanny.
Okay.
So you could say oniric, uncanny, and the next one is erotic, and the next is ambivalent, and the next is cruel.
Mm.
So there's a kind of, sadomasochistic quality that they liked about certain examples of what would be called film noir.
Sadomasochistic to the audience or to its characters?
No, in the film. Let's say the character of the femme fatale, for example, she's got something historically in common with Sade, with the Marquis de Sade's image of the cruel woman. It's a kind of sadomasochistic eroticism.
Mm.
Even though those films are highly censored. And I think a lot of those emotions that I've just mentioned, they're in Mulholland Drive, right?
I think so.
So why not call it a film noir?
Yeah.
But please don't feel obliged to. I mean, I think in a way it transcends what film noir is.
Right. And I think the best of the genre does.
Yes. I think what happens is that French movie criticism becomes very influential in America in the 1960s, let's say, the auteurist movement and all of that. And the term film noir just sounds so cool that American cinephiles pick up on it. And everybody who loves the movies now likes film noir. And there's nothing wrong with that.
Yeah, that it's true. But the surrealist influence can certainly be linked to David Lynch. So perhaps yet another reason to have it qualified.
Yeah, in this case, you have somebody who's very self-consciously aware of surrealism. And I don't know if it's right to call Lynch a surrealist. It's almost like post-surrealism. I don't know what happens to surrealism after the unconscious has already been explored. You know, what can you do after that? But he seems to me to be touching on those strange emotional effects that the feeling of disorientation, of dreamlikeness, of strange eroticism, troubling eroticism.
Right.
That they all have that. And also the other thing is about the narrative. You know, one of the things that bothers me in criticism that's been written about Mulholland Drive is that a lot of people will describe it saying that the first half, that long first half of the film involving Betty, that's Diane Selwyn's dream. And you know, it's her compensatory dream. It's like her wish-fulfilling fantasy. And then when we get to the second part of the film, that's reality. But you really can't explain the first half of the film as simply a dream. That's an attempt to turn an irrational film into something highly realistic. And I think Lynch avoids that. For me, anyway, I don't understand how certain elements in the first half of the movie that supposedly if she's dreaming, they don't really happen until the second half of the movie. And then there's this strange thing, this creature behind Winkie's, the cafe, where these two guys discuss and everything, and they go back there and find it. And that's in the last image of the film. I don't know how you can say that's part of Diane's imagination or fantasy.
I mean, the film is obviously completely open to interpretation, and I think invites multiple interpretations.
Well, I think what Lynch is, what I think is, when you see, Susan Sontag says this as well about Persona, that you shouldn't worry about trying to unravel the psychology. The film is deliberately trying to make it difficult for you to do that.
Right.
I think it's better if you just go with the emotional flow of the film or with what you were saying before, what the film says about movies.
Right.
Yeah.
Was it Stanley Kaufman who said, sense is not the point, responses
yes.
are the point. Okay.
Yes.
Yeah, I think
yeah.
that yeah. is certainly true. Though I will say, I don't think that it's incoherent. There's a plot.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah. No, no, I know that. But
yeah,
in fact, it's because there's so much of a plot that one wants to find out, oh, that this is how it is. It's
right.
Everything in the first half of the film has been dreamed. And certainly you can go a long way with that idea. But I would say you can't completely explain the first part that way.
Right. It's almost teasing us.
Yeah.
This almost makes sense.
Yeah. yeah, but it's almost like the whole key to the film is in that silencio thing where there is no band, there is no music.
Right.
Everything is lip-synced.
right, right, exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, it is the movie is about the power of fantasy.
Yeah, yeah.
And
yeah.
this is not Lynch's first foray into the dream world, obviously.
Yeah, yeah.
In your book, you write about Lost Highway.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I wonder if we can compare the two films.
Well, I think, I mean, maybe you can do it better than I can. I think that... that Lost Highway is much more in the mode of film noir. That is to say, it's quoting film noir much more than Mulholland Drive is, and it's told from a male rather than a female perspective, and but it has a similar structure except it's reversed. I guess a lot of people see it say that okay, the first half of the film is really happening, and the second half is a hallucination of some kind. Based on the mind of the male protagonist. I think that's true, but I, again, I'm a little skeptical about too easy a link between the two halves like that, even in that film. But
right.
Anyway, yeah. But otherwise, there are lots of similarities between the two films. Yeah.
Right. So in the beginning of Lost Highway, the Bill Pullman character, whose name I'm forgetting.
Yeah, I can't remember either. But yeah, he's a jazz musician.
Who may or may not murder his wife.
That's right. Yeah, and it's a sort of scene that evokes the Black Dahlia, and it's a motel like in Psycho. And anyway, there's all these references or details that you can think of from other films running through it.
Yeah, the reason that I wanted to compare Lost Highway and Mulholland Drive is, well, obviously, they are structured very similarly. They're both about movies,
yeah.
And the power of movies, the power of fantasy. But I responded so much more to Mulholland Drive, and I'm wondering why that is. Is it just because Lost Highway feels like a series of references without an emotional core?
That's what I thought when I first saw it, although I guess what I would say is that Lost Highway, just speaking for myself personally, it affected me emotionally very strongly, too. It scared the hell out of me.
Mm.
And I just thought it was extremely creepy. So I didn't get the same kind of emotional effect out of that film. It was an intense film.
Right. No, it evoked fear, not so much empathy.
Right, right. It's a good way of putting it, yeah.
Yeah. And I think that's true of a lot of Lynch's work for me.
Yeah.
That's why
I
was surprised at how resonant I found it and how much I related to the protagonist.
Right, right.
And as likable as Kyle MacLachlan is in all of Lynch's work that he appears in, I've never identified with a character as strongly as I did Diane.
Yeah, yeah.
So in your book, you mentioned that Todd McGowan calls Mulholland Drive a feminist version of Lost Highway.
Right, right.
And perhaps that's why I connect so much more with it. But then you sort of disagree. You express some skepticism about that interpretation.
Yeah.
Do you still feel that way?
Yeah, well, maybe, you know, I defer to you about this in a way. I mean, do you feel that the film is feminist? Should it be described as feminist?
Maybe it's just in comparison with his other works.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I will grant the fact that it's told from a female point of view.
Yeah.
But I think I identify with Diane as much as you do.
Right.
And I don't think just identifying with a woman character, and of course, these are constructions. They're not real people. They're characters. I mean, it's like there is no band.
Yeah.
There is no, this is all an illusion. But I don't see any feminist ideology at work in the film. Mm-hmm. I don't see anything about issues that would be important.
It's such a novel thing to feature a female protagonist in a movie like this.
Right, right.
And while there are no explicit feminist themes, it's feminist in that there's a well-rounded female at the center of it, which I can't think of. Besides Inland Empire, is there another David Lynch film that features a female at the center?
I don't think so. But Inland Empire is, in a way, a kind of companion piece to Mulholland Drive, because it's also about Hollywood and a woman.
Yeah. One of the things I really liked about it is so often we see movie lovers as male. There's a certain stereotype about people who love movies.
Yeah,
and
right.
This movie, the Mulholland Drive, defies that stereotype. So in that way, I think it's feminist.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, I will defer to Mr. McGowan, but I don't know. The politics of Lynch's films are a little difficult for me to put my finger on.
Mm.
I can identify some filmmakers as left-wing filmmakers and others right-wing. Lynch, I don't know. I don't know. And not that he has to have one politics or another to be a good filmmaker, but I don't see him. Everything is political, I guess you could say, but I don't see him as having any particular. He deals more with fetishes and the psychic quality of eroticism and violence and that sort of thing. I don't know.
Right. No, I think of him as being pretty apolitical.
Yeah. Yeah.
So let's talk about the legacy of film noir. And as you mentioned, you chose to write about Mulholland Drive as a 21st century film noir, and I'm wondering if we can compare it to other examples of the so-called neo-noir genre.
Yeah, yeah.
What separates Mulholland Drive from, say, L.A. Confidential?
Well, you could say they have Los Angeles in common, don't they?
Right.
And they have the entertainment world in common. In fact, if you want to call film noir a genre, and I don't know if you should or not, but you could say it has a subgenre of L.A. film noir. It has those things in common. But those films you're talking about are realist films, right? I mean, they're in a different kind of narrative mode from the Lynch film. And the Lynch film is more like an art film. It is an art film.
Absolutely.
By which I mean it's really breaking with the standard representational codes of Hollywood entertainment.
Right, yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, it's almost not fair to compare L.A. Confidential and Black Dahlia to Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
But
yeah.
I'm going to do it anyway.
Yeah. Well, you can. I mean, you can always. Yeah. I mean, and if you wanted to call all three of those films film noir, I wouldn't object. You know?
Yeah. I think,
but then if you didn't, that would be okay too.
They're both allowed. But neo noir is it seems to me more of a dialogue between cinema of the past and today's cinema, but all three films recall the forebearers of film noir, very very self consciously.
Right, right. But you've got, I'm sorry, go ahead.
But L.A. Confidential and Black Dahlia seem mostly interested in replicating the most obvious conventions of the genre.
Right,
whereas
Mulholland
Drive seems to want to say something else about it.
Absolutely.
Seems
and
to
also,
want to build.
Right, and also those other two films are set in one in the 50s and one in the 40s.
Yeah.
So they are in the what people think of as the historical period of classic American film noir. They are period films. Mulholland Drive is not.
Right. So one last question.
Yeah.
This film is the 28th film on the Sight and Sound Critics Poll.
Right.
Do you feel it is worthy of the 28th spot?
Well, yeah, I have to say, I voted for the poll this last time. And I found it an incredibly difficult process because they only allow you to list 10 films. And there were so many different agendas at work in my head in doing
right.
it. But if you wanted to tell me that it ranked 28th, I'm not saying that's wildly weird or anything. I didn't list it, but I think it was Sight and Sound in 2010 did an international critical poll of the best film of the first decade of the 20th century, mm-hmm. and Mulholland Drive was number one.
Yes, and it's interesting because Wong Kar-wai is In the Mood for Love actually ranks higher.
Yeah, well, you know, you can't tell these things. You don't know. In fact, I was perverse. I deliberately listed some films because I thought, well, why don't they have women directors? Or maybe I should list something that not very many people have seen.
Right. Yes.
And so I did a little bit of that.
Right. Otherwise, you've got everyone
yeah,
would pick the same 10 films.
It's the top 40 hits. You know. Anyway.
Right. Right. No, I appreciated your list. It made me happy when I saw it.
Uh huh.
It was very. I don't know how many of your choices made the top 250, but it was interesting.
I think
to look
either
at.
I think two of mine made the top 10. I'm not sure, but anyway.
How do you feel about ranking things that have come out within the last 20 years? How do you compare Mulholland Drive to Citizen Kane?
You know, that's one of the problems with these lists. When I did the list for Sight and Sound, I wrote them at the bottom, and I said, you know, I really think this is important. I like the idea of this kind of thing, but couldn't you just let people list the top 20 instead of the top 10? I mean, I had no Howard Hawks, I had no Keaton, I had no Chaplin. I didn't know what to do. anyway, yeah.
I know it's tough. I guess you just have to hope that someone else does it.
Yeah.
But I guess it's an honor to be asked to establish the canon.
Sure.
Yeah. But that being said, Mulholland Drive is an amazing film. It's my favorite Lynch film that I've ever seen.
Yeah, mine too. Yeah.
Yeah. So, and Lynch is certainly one of the most renowned filmmakers probably of all time.
He seems to have given up film. It's just weird.
Yeah. I guess we've got a new Twin Peaks to look forward to.
Oh, that's right.
Yeah.
That's right. He's back on the scene with that. I forgot about that. Yeah.
Yeah. So Lynch fans can look forward to that.
Yeah.
And in the meantime, maybe pick up Mulholland Drive.
Yeah.
In 2013, our guest, James Naramore, received a Film Scholars Grant from the Academy of Motion Picture Arts and Sciences to write a book about the great, but not widely known filmmaker, Charles Burnett. Burnett was part of a group of African-American filmmakers to emerge from UCLA's MFA film program in the 1970s, a group which was later dubbed the LA Rebellion. Burnett's best-known works are his 1978 thesis film, Killer of Sheep, the 1990 film, To Sleep with Anger, and the 1994 film, The Glass Shield. While Mr. Naramore's book won't be completed until next year, he has kindly agreed to give us a little preview of what's to come. So, Jim, tell us why you decided to write a book on Charles Burnett.
First of all, because I couldn't get anybody else to do it. For a while, I was an editor of a series of books on contemporary film directors at published by the University of Illinois. And I think I edited about 30 volumes in that series. But I could never get anybody to write about Charles Burnett. And I just thought he was such an important figure and so admirable in so many ways. A terrific artist. So finally I said, you know, I'm going to do it. I'm not writing it for that series. I'm just writing a standalone book. In a way, I hesitated because I thought, I don't know a lot about him or the period or the group that he comes from, and I'm this white guy. I don't know. He was born in Vicksburg, Mississippi in 1947, mm-hmm. and I was born in Louisiana, not very far from him, in 1941. So I've got that much in common with him. And then I met him. He came here. We have a wonderful cinema here with major directors come through town a lot. And he was here. And I really, really liked him. And he's a modest fellow, a nice guy. I think he has great integrity. So yeah. Anyway, so I just wanted to write about him.
What was your, were you just amazed when you saw Killer of Sheep? And
yeah, well, I think pretty much everybody who's seen that has to say that's a terrific movie. You know, the Library of Congress. It's first of all, you got to say it must be the greatest student film of all time. He made this as an MFA thesis at UCLA while he was a student there, and it wasn't shown until I think the late 70s in a few venues and didn't become really widely available until a few years ago when Milestone Video did a restoration and put it out. So it's not widely known, but when the Library of Congress started this list of, you know, film treasures, preservation things, it was picked in one of the very first list of essential films. And I think it is one. But I listed another one of his films when I was doing the...
The Sight and Sound poll.
The Sight and Sound, yeah. I listed To Sleep with Anger. I'm very fond of that film.
So, but while Charles Burnett might not be a household name, Killer of Sheep is considered, as you mentioned, to be a very, very significant film.
It is,
and
yeah.
It's on the Sight and Sound Critics poll. It's in the 202nd spot.
Is that right?
Yeah. So...
I think it should be about number 20 or something, or
wow.
Maybe higher. I don't know.
Yeah.
I could have listed it in my top 10, you know.
Yeah.
And anyway.
Yeah. I know when I saw it, I was astounded because, one, it feels like, as you said, it's the greatest student film of all time. It feels so accessible. Like, I could have gone out and shot it had I been living in Los Angeles during the 1970s, and yet... There's a reason,
you
know, that I didn't.
That's what you think. I don't know.
Right,
I don't
exactly.
Think either one of us that could have shot it.
I know, that's the problem. Yeah.
You know, it looks, in a way, it looks like it's almost totally improvised, but it wasn't. I mean, there's a lot of art that went into that film.
Absolutely. Yeah. Can you talk about the production of Killer of Sheep?
one of the distinctive things about this group of filmmakers of color at UCLA in late 60s and the 70s, that was part of the background against which a lot of revolutionary things were going on, and also the Vietnam War was going on at that period, and that group of filmmakers, under the guidance of a guy named Eliseo Taylor at UCLA, set up a kind of ethno-communications program, and they did a lot of looking at films through via Taylor. Things like the cinema, the what's called Cinema Novo of Brazil, Nelson Pierre de Santos, or Glauber Rocha, a lot of Latin American films, and Osmo Simbene in Africa, those kind of nationalist movements of film that were not that were aggressively against the idea of Hollywood, and that were shot under poor circumstances, often. You know, with amateurs in the crew or in the cast or whatever, and that dealt with in some kind of truthful way, working people, disenfranchised people of some kind, and so those were the big influences on Burnett, and his whole group was, they were right in the middle of Hollywood, but they didn't want to become Hollywood filmmakers.
Right.
So the idea was they created a. What in Latin America was called the cinema of poverty. Poverty not only in the sense that the camera equipment they had was fairly basic, and in Burnett's case, he went into the neighborhood he grew up in, and that film is about Watts and the working class or sub-working class world that he grew up in himself. And the things that happened in that film were things that happened to him. They're people he knows. It has images unlike any images of Black people anybody had ever seen. And anyway, it's a remarkable movie.
Absolutely, yeah. People talk about how the United States doesn't have any indie film movement because
right.
It has Hollywood.
That's right.
It is the film. It's where films are made.
Right.
But in this during this remarkable time, there was a man, there were a handful of filmmakers making movies in Los Angeles, no less.
Right.
Or,
right.
Yeah, but so, I mean, we just talked about a movie that is about the Hollywood fantasy, and now here we have a film also set in Los Angeles.
Yeah, it's absolutely the opposite end of the world. Yeah,
right, yeah, worlds apart.
Yeah, yeah. And you know, it is a socially important film, but it's not a I think one of the remarkable things about that film is Burnett said he didn't want to do the usual social problem film where, you know, if you identify this problem and if you do A, then maybe a hopeful thing will happen or something. And that's not what the film is about. It's about a guy who works in a slaughterhouse killing sheep and has to come home every day, and he has a family, and he's trying to hold the family together, but he's suffering from depression, and all around him is, you know, a poor world where people have to struggle every day, and so the degree that the film has hope, it's only in that this guy survives. He doesn't,
right.
You know, and so it's a film kind of about the day-to-day attempt to survive.
Right. How oppressive poverty can be.
Yeah, yeah.
But let's talk about Burnett's style.
Mm-hmm.
While Killer of Sheep has a very distinct style,
right?
Sort of cinema verite style,
right?
His later work is a little different.
That's right.
Talk about how it changed over time.
You know, it's interesting. I don't think, unlike a lot of other directors, especially those classic Hollywood directors who stayed within a studio for a period of time or got associated with the genre, I don't think you can say that Burnett has a style.
Mm-hmm.
Let me back off from that. I'm not saying that his films are derivative or styleless. But I think it depends on the project he works in and the circumstances under which he works, so that he's only about three times ever had the ability to make a feature film in what you would call something that would be distributed the way commercial films are distributed. And in those cases, his style is different from Killer of Sheep. I mean, Killer of Sheep it was made for $10,000. It's going to be different if he shoots a color film with a, you know, cast of professionals and so forth. But I think the interests he has as a filmmaker remain consistent. He started out as a photographer, and I think he just knows a great deal about the technology of cinema, and he has, you know, taste and skill, and he hasn't often had a lot of control over the films he worked on. So once again, that's a reason why they don't have a tourist stamp on them or anything, but they certainly have a point of view about the world. And one of his best movies, I think, and other people do too, is a movie called Night John, which was done for the Disney Channel, and it's about the plantation era South, and a slave who escapes and then comes back and tries to teach people on the plantation to read. And of course, that's the most dangerous thing to the system there can be, and he's cruelly punished for it. But it's a powerful, powerful film. But it's when you go, it goes back to the bits about the style. Whenever Burnett's been interviewed about it, he said, "Well, my chief disappointment is it doesn't have a roughness. It doesn't have what would seem the feel of slavery and the roughness of a plantation life.
It's too polished.
It looks too good."
Yeah. Well, so you mentioned that perhaps there's no consistent aesthetic, but what are some of the most prevalent themes?
Well, I guess one of the themes that's important, especially in his early films, well, first of all, you could say overarching, his films are about Black people. They are about a wide range of experience of Black people, both in the U.S. and abroad, and that's his primary center of interest. A lot of the early films have to do with what I think was part of his experience growing up in Watts, coming from people who had moved from the South, from Mississippi, to Watts, and there's a kind of country versus city interest in his work. The culture that he grew up in was trying to divest itself of sounding countrified. We're in Los Angeles now. We shouldn't use those old expressions we did. And a film like To Sleep with Anger is very much about a visitor from the South, a kind of folkloric figure who comes into a family in Los Angeles. Seems kind of lower middle class family still has chickens in the backyard.
Right. I was marveling at the estate. Where did they get that piece of property?
Yeah.
It's enormous. Yeah. Anyway,
that's a kind of a theme that's run through his work. But you know, as time is going on, he still remains a socially committed director who makes. He's made some great short films. He's a master of short films. They don't get distributed very much, but he has three or four short films that I would say are masterpieces. But in a way, those are his most Charles Burnett-ish films. Mm. Something like The Glass Shield, for example, it was distributed by Miramax, and that's not his cut of the film.
Okay.
And but even there, though, he tried to do something a little different. He tried to use a kind of, if you like, comic book expressionism in the film, having to do with the fantasy of this young black recruit in the LAPD who fantasizes about what the adventure of being a police officer. So there's some sort of deliberately expressionistic touches in that film. Yeah.
Did he come up with the comic book title
cards?
Okay.
Yeah,
that was him.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Do you think any of the trouble he's had stems from the racism in Hollywood?
That's a hard one for me to answer. I want to say yes, but yeah. I don't have any proof of that.
Yeah.
And I think most of Hollywood likes to try to think of itself as liberals. But I think when it comes to, there are all black films today Tyler Perry makes a very profitable series of films about, for black audiences, all
Absolutely.
Black. So it's not that because he's dealing with black subjects. I think it's more because there's more of a kind of an authenticity and integrity to what he does. It's a social concern. They're just not the kinds of films that go under the mantle of entertainment always, you know?
Yeah. So if a listener is interested in checking out some of Burnett's films, where would you suggest they start?
You mean which films to see?
Yeah, which films did you see first?
Well, Killer of Sheep, obviously, Jay Hoberman wrote somewhere that, unfortunately, Burnett has the same problem as Orson Welles. That is, his first film is so notable that it kind of weighs on everything after that. But yeah, Killer Sheep is a place to start. And but then the film he made after that, it's called My Brother's Wedding. Mm-hmm. That's equally good, and that's available on DVD.
Yes.
And To Sleep with Anger is not currently available on U.S. DVD, which I think is appalling.
It is. Though if you live in Los Angeles and you go to Cinephile, they do have a copy.
Oh, they
just
do?
FYI,
okay.
Yes. I don't know if it's an official copy, but...
Yeah. You know, I was teaching at UCLA a couple of years ago, and I used to go by that place on the bus all the time, and I never went inside.
Oh,
so.
I highly recommend you do next time you're in Los Angeles.
It looks like a pretty hip place. They had a Bellatar t-shirt hanging in the window.
Yes, they do.
Yeah.
I didn't mention this, but Jim is in Indiana right now, correct?
That's right, under about a foot of snow out here.
Oh, goodness. Mm-hmm. But yeah, so this is being recorded over Skype. I want to let our listeners know. So that's the reason for the different tones in our microphone. So
okay.
But yeah, so To Sleep with Anger, you were saying?
Oh, yeah. But there are, there are some short films that you can find on the Milestone Video. That I think are very good. Anyway, that's a good starting place.
All right, fantastic. Before we sign off, I like to find any excuse to mention Orson Welles on every podcast, and this episode will be no exception. The University of Illinois Press is coming out with a revised and expanded edition of Mr. Naremore's book, The Magic World of Orson Welles, later this year. And while we still have him here, I thought James could give listeners a brief overview of the book, and what they can expect from the expansion. So, Can you give us a brief synopsis of The Magic World of Orson Welles?
The book was written back in the 70s, the original book, and it's gone through a couple of editions since then, each one a little larger. But, basically the book concentrates on the films, and it takes a more or less chronological approach to the films. And I would say that, in my view, one of the strongest features of the book originally was it does a lot of, like, close analysis of the films from an aesthetic point of view. And I think it also politicizes Welles more than previous writers had done.
In terms of Blacklist or...
Right. His left... The left nature of his work, which grows out of the Popular Front in the 1930s, and he remains kind of a left wing. But anyway, so there's that. And what I've done in this new thing is I've written a rather long introduction called Orson Welles at 100, which tries to go over the work that's been done since the last edition of this book on Welles. Wonderful things like Joe McBride's book, Whatever Happened to Orson Welles. Then it also tries to talk about things that I felt I didn't say enough about before or didn't, whatever. For example, I was unaware the last time of the FBI investigation of Welles during the Blacklist era. But also, I think I wanted to take the opportunity to discuss Welles in a kind of multimedia terms in this introduction. Because Welles, we know he was an important innovator in radio, but he also had some really interesting ideas for TV. People haven't seen a lot of his TV work. A short film he made called The Fountain of Youth.
Yes.
Which he made
That's
for
Desi. That's a great one.
It is a terrific film.
Yes.
It's a little masterpiece and a very unusual, formally unusual film. And I think it's the beginning of the essay film for Welles, which
right.
really culminates with F or Fake. And I try to emphasize a lot his pedagogical interests. I think he always liked to lecture to audiences and thought of himself in a way as a kind of teacher.
Hmm.
And everybody knows he's a magician, but I think he's also a pedagogue.
Yeah.
And I think the tension between those two things for me counts for a lot with him.
Yeah.
So there's that. And then, I've stuck in stuff along the way, short things, and expanded a fair amount the other side of the wind because we know more about that.
I was going to ask
now.
You about that.
Yeah. But I think I owe a lot of my knowledge of that to Joe McBride. But then I also know here at this big Welles collection we have at the Lilly Library here in Bloomington, that we also have Peter Bogdanovich's papers, and it has a lot of stuff on the other side of the wind. So I was able to use some of that. This is all precipitated by the fact that, of course, it's the Welles Centennial, but there's going to be one of those giant things going on here in Bloomington at this truly great cinema we have here now.
Yeah.
Joe McBride will be there, Jonathan Rosenbaum, everybody who's written about Welles, and maybe several filmmakers as well. Chuck Workman, who's just done this nice little documentary on Welles.
Yeah. So when will the new edition be available?
Well, they're trying to rush it into print. In fact, right here on my floor in front of me right now are the proof pages, and I'm going through them. I don't think it's going to be available in early May by, Welles' birthday.
The 6th, yeah.
Yeah, but it should be available pretty soon after that.
And that's the way we frame it, Flixwise, that is. If you'd like to offer up your own theory about what the heck is going on in Mulholland Drive, come leave us a comment on our website, flixwise.com. Or you can make your way to our Facebook page, facebook.com/flixwise. You can also find me and my receptive pair of ears, both of which are still firmly attached to my head, on Twitter. The handle is @flixwise. Maybe I should have saved that joke for Blue Velvet. But before you do any of that, please subscribe and leave us a comment on iTunes. Help us stand out in their database. On our next show, better hunker down because we're heading into an apocalyptic wasteland with Andrei Tarkovsky's Stalker. Until then, James, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Well, I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so much. Such an honor to have you on. Until next time, drive safe, folks. Silencio.